Welcome to Edible Words, as we delve into the world of creative food and experience design. We bring together inspiring people from different backgrounds to talk about past, current, and future food and design trends. From food culture to eating spaces, food science, and experience design, we want to talk about it all. Add to that a pinch of well-being, curiosity, sustainability, creativity, and of course, our senses. I'm Maud, a creative food and experience designer based in London in the UK, although I like to move quite a lot, so you might find me elsewhere. I'm the founder of Salty Studio, a food design studio exploring innovative and sensory experiences around food. Edible Words was born during the first lockdown in 2020, after all my events were cancelled, and most of everyone else's. And I've really enjoyed connecting with amazing people from around the world. Join us as we embark on this journey to understand more about our connection with food through design systems. So, hi, Caroline. It's lovely to have you here. And actually, it's the second time that you've joined us because we had one of the Edible Words live talk a few months ago. And you gave us actually a special experience around food and sound. That was really fascinating. So maybe do you want to introduce yourself and what you do?
Sure. It's lovely to be back. Thank you for having me. My name is Caroline Hopkinson. So I started off as a fine artist. I've always been fascinated by food, the textures, the sound, the smells, anything to do. So I think I'm driven by greed. And as I came to London when I was 18, to study at Central St. Martin's, but I was very, just super excited by immersive art and theatre and the spectacle and performance. So I managed to actually combine my love of art and spectacle and performance with food and performing it through numerous sculptural installations, quite complicated dining events, which would take people, I know, from being driven in the middle of the night to secret places, being blindfolded, to a lot of academic research, especially neuroscientific research when it comes to food and flavor and taste perception and how we can modulate and actually play with it to make people taste something completely differently just by listening to certain sounds.
But so how was your experience around food growing up?
I'm from Germany, and in West Germany, that was in the 80s, the land of plenty. So there was a lot of food, a lot of processed food. The celebration was always there, tables heaving with Haribos and sweets. And then my dad, who came from Poland, took me in 84 for the first time back to the Eastern Bloc. And it was a really exciting moment for him, obviously, because he wasn't allowed back. But for me, it was very much realizing that there was another world out there as well between having a lot of food and not having a lot of food. So we brought a lot of food with us in the car, and I didn't realize for no reason whatsoever. And I brought over, obviously sweets, and they were looked all really colorful. And we were standing at some point in Krakow, which is this beautiful, a big city. And I said, I'm so hot. I really want a lemonade. And he said, in that weird tone, like a Fanta. And he said, you can't have that. There is no such a thing as a Fanta. And I just couldn't believe it at that time because, as a five-year-old, the idea that something exists outside. That was probably the first time I realized that food is, there are different worlds and different worlds are how we inhabit food as well. That's what your natural food way is, growing up in France would be really difficult to us. But obviously, until now, obviously, I love that how our biography is written often by food. So people say Cheerios, because often the multinational brands, what they do is we all have the same food experiences. But occasionally you break out of that little world where you realize, okay, that's something that we only had, like the way that people make pancakes or waffles. And people are very they get quite angry as well when they're prepared in a different way to the natural family tradition. And I love that, how emotional we get with food. I think a lot of feuds and wars are almost started by regional cuisine.
Yeah, and actually there's a lot of Italian recipes, for example, that if you don't do it the right way, it gets really frustrating for some people.
I went back just because I'm so interested in food rituals and authenticity of food. So I went back to SOAS to study the anthropology of food as well and the rituals around it and authenticity of food and how people take that with them. And I see especially refugees, I find internally it's incredibly fascinating because this makes out the identity you keep with us. It's so ingrained in who we are that people cook it. But then sometimes you have strange versions of a dish that are not authentic to the people back in Italy, but you have the Italian food in America, like meatballs and or spaghetti bolognese. That's something that is evolved through Italian immigrants merging with local foods. And I love those, like the chicken katsu curry. It's a lot of German soldiers stationed in Japan at the time, and they recreated schnitzel, and they were yearning for schnitzel, and they kept on talking about schnitzel. And until someone started making the katsu curry. So this is that is the impact of people yearning for something. Mm. So it's that weird fusion food. And now we all eat chicken katsu curry, which is Japanese and German.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love understanding as well, like this sort of how the food changes over time. Actually, one of my teachers at the university when I did the master's in food design, he was telling us that he was Italian and he moved to the US to teach at a design school in New York. And when he first arrived there, I think he met some other Italian people and they said, "Oh, amazing, another Italian, come and have dinner with us. We'll make you something typical Italian." And they made him something and he was saying it was really awkward because it wasn't really what it wasn't really authentic not the same as the food that he had back in Italy. So it was embarrassing a little bit for him because he felt that, oh, like our food has been exported, our food culture has been exported in the wrong way. But then also for the people who are the Italians who are living in the US, I think they felt probably frustrated as well and embarrassed because they thought, oh, we're not doing it right and it should be our own food culture. And so I think it's so interesting.
I love that. And I like the anger. It's like the food culture, who does it belong to? But looking especially at Italian food culture, you have obviously most of the food came with Marco Polo and from China as well. So the idea of noodles and a lot of rice dishes like a risotto is obviously, that's not that authentically Italian as well. And the tomato only arrived in Italy in the 1920s. But it's so such a huge part of Italian cooking is the tomato and the soup, you know, like the succo and the tomato, like the passatas. It's just incredible to think that's actually quite recent. So I think it's incredible how sensitive we are towards new food trend and people say, oh, it's so newfangled and it's weird. So I think that, but it's actually, it's always been guided by big, new ways of obviously being able to export food, having better cooling systems on big ships, and sometimes through negativity as well, like post Black Death in London, like the food waste changed as well. And I think that gives us a absolutely super fascinating new way of actually looking at our new food waste as well coming, you know, like post COVID as well. So it's like, okay, once it stops, there's always scope for new and it's never, never been like this. So like one of my favorite examples is a birthday cake. We all assume the birthday cake is something that we have the right to and it's been celebrated. But if you ask people who are in their 80s now, they wouldn't have celebrated their birthday with a birthday cake and candles. It's a very recent tradition and a ritual that just came up, but it spread like wildfire all over the world that you almost assume this is what everyone does. Mm. It feels universal, but it's always been there, but it hasn't been there. Like, you know, like in Victorian London, people would celebrate their name days, like the saint days. So I think that's often very important to remember that we don't have to be so stuck in our ways when it comes to food.
And that's definitely something that I'm find fascinating is how things change over time as well, because even within one country the food can really change. I was studying for my dissertation when I was again back at university and doing my BA, and I was looking at the food culture in Russia. And that's changed quite a bit because during the sort of more imperialist times, there was a lot of French influence and they had lots of French chefs coming. And then you had the revolution and then the Soviet times came in and the food sort of became a bit more simple, but yet also was starting to be influenced by all the other countries that were part of the Soviet Union. So I had a really interesting book where a lot of the recipes that came from the sort of typical Soviet recipes were actually from all these different countries, and not just Russia, for example. And then as soon as the Soviet time sort of ended, they started looking at Western food a lot more, and they didn't really want to hear anything about Soviet food. So there's a lot of French, Italian food again in restaurants. And then now it's slowly coming back, which is really interesting. So I think it changes all the time, and people are questioning, well, what was my food culture, and what were the dishes from my childhood? What memories do these bring? And because of all the different generations that we have, maybe some meals for some.
Yeah, because our food memories are so powerful, because they are linked to obviously a multi-sensory, choreography as well. And they really transport us back to former versions of ourselves. But obviously often nostalgia, heavy and rose-tinted as well. The idea of, that's the way I had the crisps after being at the seaside and being really cold after a swim. And that's so much that you can make people cry if you have the certain washing powder or a certain dish at the certain time, because it really, it's that Proust idea of the involuntary memory. It's like it really transports us back to our former 6-year-old self. And it's like the idea of because it bypasses the rational part of our brain. And that's why I think it's so powerful as well, how we can reenact those moments. But I think subconsciously we do react those moments, the idea of comfort, the cup of tea and the comfort and just how people dunk their biscuit. Mostly that this is a habitus that's been established when they were between, 6 and 10. And then people reenact that, mostly people don't change the way they dunk a biscuit or how they have a hot drink with a pastry moment. It's something that has been established in childhood. And then we play it out over and over again because it connects us to the one moment.
Yeah, or probably influenced a bit by their parents, I think, as well, or the way that they had it with their family. And fascinating. And so what brought you to explore the field of food and sound then?
I always like food as a multi-sensory choreography. And then investigating into the different senses, it was a big part of me, and just idea that heightening the experience, and especially when you think about what is an experience, how do we know we're there, and how that can be interlinked by things like smell, of course, is very obvious, and sight, because it's our, unless you're blind, it's our leading sight. And then I came across some research with Professor Charles Spence, who I subsequently worked quite a lot with and became a dear friend as well. The idea that he had this bittersweet symphony. And when I came across it, I thought, nah, that can't be. It's too far out. It reminds me of something like the 1970s when the Americans did, talking to goats, the idea of, he can subconsciously change people by listening to a certain frequency. But then I tasted coffee with a high frequency and with a low frequency, and really I could change the idea that the high frequency brought out a sweetness and the low frequency brought out the bitterness in the coffee. And I thought, gosh, that's incredible. Just think about the possibilities. And I'm a big lover of tech and the idea of being able to download a QR code and going to a coffee place, and instead of having sugar in your coffee, being able to just calibrate a sound frequency that's already in my phone via Spotify or something else to get that perfect frequency and to calibrate it to my personal preference of sweetness. I thought it's incredible as well, especially now I'm really excited, because 2 years ago when I mentioned QR codes and all of that, before, people said oh, that's all really complicated and maybe you need headphones. But I think that is one of the weird side effects as well of our new world, is that we have our smartphone always with us. Most people invested in really good headphones, and downloading QR codes is something that we do all the time anyway. So I think that's a really interesting way of unlocking digital information really quickly and having that within. So I think sound is really good because it's cheap. It's obviously free. It adds so much to food. but it really anchors it. I mean, it can go in three ways. You have the texture and the mouthfeel that changes. The idea of, you know, when you have dry nori and you have the lapping waves of the sea, it really creates moisture in your mouth. So it really makes you salivate and makes you counteract it. But it can anchor it really simply in terroir as well. The idea of honoring a food. And I think that's really interesting with sustainability, of saying that, okay, this is where the cheese is from, and that's where the sound of the bells of the goat, and this is the bees. And you're hearing this really enriches your experience of the food, but it honors it as well, rather than just having it as a unconnected space. And I think we all like that. And I think something that's been quite obvious in the past for us to have that this is cheese because, for instance, cheese, but or wine especially, you know, like the idea of there's, you know, like generations of love and care linked to a special terroir, and bringing that with a product into a wider world, I think it's a really beautiful way of enhancing that.
Yeah, and I think especially, I mean, that's something that we've discussed, I think, during some of my other talks, when that we've changed our perceptions, I think, around food since COVID started, because of not being able to access food as easily as we thought. So maybe in some places, and I think it's really made us question, like, where does food come from? What is what's the process? What are the ingredients? And I think a lot of, especially children, I think, and maybe the younger generations don't really, they might feel like it's just so easy to access, and you could just quickly buy something without really knowing if it's in season, or if it's, if the production methods are sustainable and ethical. And I think more and more are questioning that, actually. So I think it's, I think there is a lot of movement happening, and I think a lot of people are changing their ways. I know, for example, the food delivery boxes worked pretty well during the pandemic and during the lockdown. Like companies like Oddbox and things like that are doing pretty well, like selling waste or ugly vegetables.
I absolutely adore that. Yeah, it's because I think rationally, like from a rational point of view, we all know that it's much better to have local food, to know about the preference or like the where food comes from. But I think it's really beautiful as well, just knowing where that it's actually from a sustainable place, and knowing where it's from actually adds to the enjoyment of it as well. And that it's like the idea of the sensory enjoyment, knowing about this, and how can we communicate that? Like having a link to the grower and to the farmer, and just having, because having just food as a very cold commodity, it lessens our enjoyment for it. It's really bad for food waste. It's really bad for the environment on many levels. But actually, it makes us eat more mindful as well. It's like, I mean, it makes us honor the food there, rather than just, it just becomes an abstract and something that you have to buy. And I think that, I think that's now that we had to become this hunter-gatherers in the pandemic, the idea that food, because food waste broken, I think it's a really healthy rethink, and I hope the government will actually restart having much more awareness of it. I'm actually part of it's a multi-university task force of the government, and how to utilize the new thinking of food waste of COVID, and how to move forward for it, and the idea of local farming and the locality, because now we are forced to use our local shops and maybe local farm food as well, and how to make sure that this is not parked as soon as we have access to wider food waste as well. Because it's the awareness and the knowledge that obviously it tastes better, it's better for us, but it's cheaper as well. And I think that's a really beautiful coming together of many positive points as well. But I think ultimately we're always going to make those food choices or are willing to pay more if we get more enjoyment or sensory pleasure from it. So when it comes to bread or food and like cheese or wine, I'm much more willing to pay more money and honor the craft that goes into it if I get the enjoyment, rather than just on the rationale saying that, because it's more sustainable produced seems a bit too rational for many. So the higher price
I really hope
point.
I think a lot of us are looking forward to when things open up again and we can experience things with all our senses. But can you so you've been obviously working on this project called Unusual Ingredients, and that combines food and sound. So can you maybe explain a bit more to us what brought you to explore that particular connection, and and how did that how did the also the exploration around food and sound affect your own eating habits?
Yeah, I mean, my dream is always the idea of, okay, rather than working with existing food and like sound frequencies, the idea of producing some. But obviously I'm not a musician, so not out of the blue, but 3 years ago, actually, Jacob from Leeds, the conservatoire, contacted me, and he's an incredible composer and a doctor in experimental music. And he suggested to actually team up to go with some art funding and create a library and food frequencies that are specifically calibrated to certain foods. Based on that, we got a lot of art funding, luckily, and from the Arts Council Britain and different music funds, and create a series of events to give people the experience to actually just to see how you can modulate and heighten and amplify a certain texture and a certain taste in food. That project was last year, because obviously in March how everything came to halt. But then we managed to bring it online in a really interesting way. So we had a lot of interesting online talks and get-togethers, and we managed to do a lockdown kit as well. So actually over Christmas that became so successful, we need to actually ask other people to help us pack
Amazing.
All those lockdown kits as well. So that was a really interesting thing, because it's like the idea of people trying and having that yearning and hunger for learning more about food while you're locked in, because obviously food is how we experience things. It's like the idea of eating is something that is really raw, and we interact with our environment. So the idea of connecting with people somewhere else and eating together, and I love that as well during lockdown, that I managed to actually be much closer to friends that were further away over a glass of wine. But I think we're all very excited to be able to be in a restaurant and with a loud, I think it's as well that the sound of other people, and I know it sounds usually interesting, but I think we're going to love the idea of the cutlery, the kitchen sounds, the urgency of, the kitchen saying a dish is ready, service, someone asking for service, the wine falling down. This is the soundscape against like the theater and the beauty of a restaurant meal out as well, rather than just that pent up silence, of all the so many home meals.
Exactly. Well. Yeah. And I think, or like the street food as well, I think like being able to just have things in our hands and use our hands a lot more, because even before I even look at some of the dishes I used to make for the supper clubs that I used to host and have people interacting with each other, sort of using their hands. And that's something that even now we feel so strange about, I think, and because of all the hygiene rules and everything. So I really hope that we can...
be really interesting to see how it goes back to food sharing, because obviously there was a big trend of sharing dishes, and I think you couldn't actually eat anywhere in London with individual portions and not having sharing dishes. So and I think the idea of sharing food is obviously the ultimate human, very universal interaction, which is obviously ever since we started gathering around a fire, and the idea of sharing a fire and sharing dishes is something that makes us human. That's exactly the difference, to that, the idea of telling stories while we're eating. And I think that's something that hopefully we'll be able to reestablish, the idea of, and I love nothing else more than having people over and having a big, sharing dish in the middle of the table. We can all help ourselves. And I think there's something so generous and wonderful about it. But I think this is ultimately, that's the reason we don't have sharp knives at the table, is because the table and coming together over food is our way of expressing that I'm your friend, I come in peace, and it's making peace. And that's, that's exactly the reason that every time we actually order food in a restaurant that needs cutting, the waiter needs to bring an extra sharp knife, because traditionally we don't bring weapons to the table. It's a time of peace. And I think that's something that's really missing. And I think people are really missing the time, sharing time over the table. And judging by the restaurant reservations in London, I try to get a table. They are very booked up in a lovely way.
Yeah,
I think, because people are very excited about, I think, sharing that
exactly.
meal
with friends. And that's sort of all part of the rituals around food. And actually, this reminds me of a book that I was reading, I'm sure you know about it, called The Rituals of Food, or The Rituals of Dining, I think, from Margaret Visser. And it's so interesting, and it actually brings me to the next point that I want to talk to you about, because this book is so fascinating. They talk about all the different rituals at different food cultures and all along history as well, that there are around just simply the act of dining. And actually, one of the first topics that they talk about is cannibalism. And I know that you've done some research around that and like eating flesh and some quite taboo food rituals, but also some slightly more acceptable things, like eating insects. So Yuzhu, what's your like inspiration behind these research pieces, and why like why cannibalism, for example?
I'm obviously just always fascinated by the more obscure and the idea of understanding where cannibalism came from, or the idea of actually it's just about, you know, like taking in the power of the other person. And interestingly enough as well, you know, like as a Catholic, the idea of cannibalism is really interestingly merged in religion, the idea that we eat the body of Christ. And actually a lot of churches have that reenactment every Sunday. And it comes from, you know, like if you look into through Babylonian cultures and Egyptian, you know, the goddess cult, the idea of the sun god, you know, you eat your God. And I think that's a really interesting idea, the idea of that empowering you spiritually by that. So I think that cannibalism is really interesting, but obviously it's the ultimate taboo yeah. as well, and breaking that taboo. But it's really interesting how we look at, you know, a lot of, you know, I love to go to somewhere like the Horniman Museum of the Soane collection in London and look at examples of those rituals. And, you know, like especially like there's some fabulous South American little heads and like the leftovers of cannibalism. But then you think like, but you know, equally like the idea of having the body of Christ dished out every Sunday, it's equally bizarre as well. So I think that's for me, it's very powerful. It's like the sense of shivers down my spine thinking about the idea. But I think food taboos are really interestingly because that's exactly where we establish our boundaries of human. And this is idea, this is what you do and this is not. Because I think interacting by eating food is the most intimate way we interact with the environment. You know, the idea of, you know, unless I have sex and become pregnant, that's just a momentary thing. But by putting food in my mouth, it becomes part of my body and my system. You can almost see that I drank coffee in the strand of my hair. You can see it because it forms cells in our body. So food really stays with us, you know, like from a metaphysical point of view as well. And I think thinking about food taboos as well, the idea of edible, you know, like insects is the ultimate taboo for a lot of people. On the other hand, it's one of the only solutions to keep all be happy together and keep eating as a fabulous source of protein. But I think it's interesting.
And it's taboo in some places, but not everywhere, actually. It's taboo in the Western world, but then in the East, it's a very common thing, and it's completely normal.
And more people almost eat it. But I think it's really interesting looking at prawns, for instance. Prawns are just insects of the sea, and they look physically very similar. You know, like the physiognomy of a grasshopper and a prawn is exactly the same thing. But, you know, unless you were, you know, living in a beautiful seaside town in France, you wouldn't That's have true. Eaten many prawns or octopus. So this is something that only came up in the last probably 40 years. And my grandmother, yes, but my great-grandmother locked in Germany wouldn't have eaten a prawn because it would look like the insect. So I think you overcome those things. And I think drawing the similarity between prawns and scampi and other insects actually helps people to think, because we have no qualms of taking it apart, breaking it apart. The idea of crustaceans, they are very much like they have the exoskeleton. They are very similar to an insect. Like they have the same crunch, what people like, and they don't have That's a problem true. Putting them on the barbecue. So it's a really interesting line, and actually digging deeper, like what is that? I think it's just more about having early education, maybe infiltrating the idea of food knowledge when it comes to children. Have children eat it as a child. I think if you've been exposed to it as a child, it's something that's much easier to overcome. But I think a grown person, after you obviously forever being conditioned to say that insects is always connected, whether it's maggots or anything, like even ants around forgotten, like apple cake in a garden, it's always a sign of, oh no, I'm not going to eat it. But it's interesting. It's like the, you know, like in Europe, you have a lot of bees in bakeries, which is really funny. And most people still order food at the same bakery while there are swarming bees all over it. And it's completely natural. It's like whether you go in like anywhere on continental Europe, but the idea of having anything
you have so many regulations.
In this country as well.
That's true. I never thought about that actually.
That you would not be able to sell it. So I think it's something really interesting. It's just because you've been exposed to it from a little child. So I wouldn't see it as unhygienic to have like a cake swarming with bees and then the patisserie lady or the person just wafts it away and then they package it up for you. But here it's something that is such a taboo again. So I think it's just more about thinking and overcoming it and actually just questioning exactly what it is. And I think there's a lot of exciting scope for eating insects, but it's not going to be as easy as because convincing me to eat it, because I find it very grim. I think contextually, if you set it into a context, if you say, okay, that's part of a South American dish and it's in a Chilean dish,
the
then it's maybe more acceptable. But I mean, I think taking it out out of context is always really weird. Because if I would say to a Scottish person, you go to the next lake or loch and you take a salmon and you're going to bite into the raw salmon, you would think I'm a lunatic. But while the same salmon is beautifully cut as a plate of sushi, the same person would say, that's wonderful. And I think because a sushi is ingrained in, you know, like centuries of Japanese culture, because food is culture. So once you ingrain it and anchor it in culture, it's more acceptable.
Yeah, and I think different countries have different sort of taboos, but also different limits to what they like. So I know like in some Asian countries, they like chewy textures and things like that. Whereas in more European countries, we really struggle with that. Even things like horse meat, it's actually quite common, I think, in France, whereas in the UK, we would never even think about that. And there's a huge taboo around that.
Yeah. It becomes a scandal. Yes, there was a horse meat scandal, the idea that there was 5% of horse meat in there.
Yeah. Whereas in France,
again, it's a very natural side effect. Yeah. It's sustainability, because what else are you going to do with an old horse? So I think it's really interesting how that is contextual and cultural as well. But I think as soon as you're anchored in something like a story, I think it's much more acceptable. The idea, if you tell me, okay, you know, like even the idea of like what we do with eggs, you know, like over Easter, it's such a weird symbol of fertility, and the idea of having it and people eat eggs like there's nothing else. But it doesn't make any sense. It becomes very surreal and abstract, but because it's anchored in the absolute symbol of renewal and fertility, we kind of get that. And it's something that is acceptable to have this, you know, like whether they're remade out of chocolate or not, and everyone just eats eggs as if we are renewed ourselves by eating eggs. But actually it doesn't make any sense.
I think it's fascinating. I think the different food cultures from around the world and the different ways we see things and what we associate to certain types of food.
Often they're universal as well, you know, like the holy festival in Hindu culture, and then you have Passover and you have Easter. They all coincide, you know, like very similar with the equinox. There's a real natural reason for the way the year goes as well. And I think that's a really sensible way to look at it. It makes sense, the idea of you don't eat something for a while and then you have a big feast. Why exactly at the time that everything is used up? So it makes sense to have those things. Now we have to have the idea of intermittent fasting, but that was quite natural to a lot of cultures. The idea of that constant snacking and grazing is not necessarily the...
So actually our whole food industry is sort of being challenged at the moment, and we've spoken about this a bit before, but whether it's the restaurants that have to close for a long period of time and then food waste coming out from that, from the different producers. I know I was hearing about some stories in South Africa where when they closed some of the restaurants, a lot of the local producers had just so much surplus food, and yet there were still loads of communities that were really struggling to access food. And also this whole inequality around access to safe and healthy food. The last thing that I wanted to talk about with you was, what sort of concerns do you have for our food culture and our food industry today, and what actually are some really nice things that are happening now?
I think what's really amazing is the idea of the appreciation of the local, because of the food waste being questioned. And I think drawing transparency towards it, the way that, you know, like the UK exports most of our salmon, And it comes from Canada. Weirdly, Canada and the US are importing most of our salmon. So it's like, why is there such a, it doesn't make any sense. But it's really interesting. And I think it's really important, you know, like one of the, you know, if there could be ever any positive side effects run by the new, you know, political structures that are being drawn up via Brexit and different food trade wars, is that we are more aware where our food comes from. And sometimes it doesn't make any sense. Why are we exporting everything and importing everything that just adds a lot of cost to it? And why is it cheaper to import, you know, an apple from the other side of the world, you know, as far
when
as
we grow
Chile,
some in the UK,
rather than growing it homegrown, you know? So I think, but I think as well, part of that really interesting thing, and I think that's where you get people, it comes to the health thing, the idea of if I eat honey that has been produced with the local pollen and the local blossoms in my area, then my allergy towards that goes completely down because I've been exposed to them through the honey. So I think it's really interesting as well when you link health to it, the idea of milk being produced in your local thing is actually much less allergenic to you as a milk produced somewhere really far away. And I think for me, that's a really interesting health point view as well. It's the idea of our gut biome as well. It's like a really the idea of the local. Obviously, it's much nicer, it's cheaper, but it's actually, it's incredibly how unhealthy it is to have you know, like the idea of traveling. We've all had that, traveling and having milk from somewhere in India, suddenly, like most people have that extreme reaction to it. But I think that's exciting. And I think hopefully that will lead to much more of the local food waste being reestablished. The idea that there was a big pause, and I think it shows how vulnerable we are as well. I mean, recently I thought that was fascinating when the Suez Canal was blocked. Just to show that actually in comparison to, you know, like a whole pandemic that brought all our world to the standstill, the Suez Canal being closed for 3 days had much more of an impact to local food waste than the pandemic, because it just shows that it's all about weird food logistics of food being shipped around the world. And I think if the consumer has a lot of power, and I think enriching the power, but I think the idea of, I think it has to be driven by joy and, you know, like the idea that it's better for you from a health point of view, but as well, it just tastes better as well, rather than just on the rational fact that we shouldn't be doing this, because that's really hard to overcome.
It's funny because I feel like I'm in between sometimes with, I think the local side of things is so important, as you just said, for our health as well. But then I think we're so lucky in London, we've got access to so much food around. And so I think it's sometimes it's also amazing that we have access to all this food from around the world, and you don't even need to travel in the end, or don't even need to have to be able to afford to go to India, for example, and then try all these different foods. And even though I love traveling and I think it's so important to learn about different food cultures. It's something that I love talking about, because I think it's, I don't think it's black and white.
Yeah. Because you can fully immerse yourself in India. I mean, maybe that is almost borderline cultural appropriation, but what we started doing in London in lockdown is putting Indian music on and chopsticks on. And then you know, like I have a chapati pan, which I never used just as a tourist item. I once bought in Karachi on a market, and I've never used it. And I started making chapatis and, you know, Indian food. And then we have the Indian music, and then I literally the other day actually dressed up, you know, like in a sari, just sitting down there. But you really transport yourself. And I think it is a multi-sensory immersion as well of food that we're looking for. And then you feel like the food tastes much more authentic, and it's because it's an interplay of that choreography of the smell and the sound. And it's amazing how you can actually play with it. And I think a lot of people did play with that, the idea of how to create it at home. So I hope restaurants as well, I think there's going to be, I think the first time I'm going to have an indoor business, I'm going to wear a ball gown. I think people would love the spectacle and the idea of having that. I think there will be a learning for the yearning for the theatre of it as
well. Exactly. Well, we all can't wait. And I hope this comes fairly soon. But it was lovely to have you. I mean, I'm sure we can go on and talk about all these super interesting topics for ages. But thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.